Okay, welcome to May 22nd on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. I am your host, Joseph DiCristoforo. And I'm not doing this show because I'm actually a history teacher, because really, I'm not a teacher of much of anything at all. I do the show because I'm a proud patriotic American. And hopefully you're listening because you're a proud American as well. So, having said that, let's begin the show with a Pledge of Allegiance. Let's all stand up. Let's face the flags and put our right hands over our hearts and begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Very nice. Now, moving on to today's program.
I'll talk about election news. Van Buren is unanimously elected the leader of the Democratic Party. Plus, the brutal caning of Senator Charles Sumner. House Cavern is purchased in Cobleskill, New York. And Cloward Piven's calls for socialism in America.
All right, so now let's do this!
1835. Van Buren unanimously becomes the leader of the Democratic Party. Just in time for the 1836 presidential election. What a show, folks. The Petticoat Affair, the rise of the Whigs, Julia Chin, and a surprisingly close race. The Anti-Masonics, who, as the name would imply, were opposed to Freemasonry, and were a semi-legit party in the 1832 election between Andrew Jackson and Henry Clay and several National Republicans, but fizzled out quickly and merged with a newly formed Whig Party. The Petticoat Affair was a sex scandal regarding the appointment of John Eaton to Secretary of War by President Jackson. Eaton was having a relationship with a young 23-year-old girl named Margaret Petty, who, not saying she got around or anything, but let's just say she had a reputation of being on more laps than a napkin, if you dig what I'm saying. Peggy was married to a sailor, who died unexpectedly, supposedly from suicide from learning of his wife's affairs. Nonetheless, John Eaton's romance with her would continue, and as a result, Eaton was booed from his Washington constituents. Old Hickory Jackson, who had his own sex scandals regarding his wife Rachel, long story, sympathized with Eaton and appointed him Secretary of War, hence the scandal. Meanwhile, the Whigs were making a name for themselves and felt that they had a shot at defeating the Jacksonian Democrats by utilizing the strategy that got John Quincy Adams elected over Old Hickory Jackson in the 1824 election. Throw a bunch of Whigs in the race and prevent the Democrats from winning a majority, and letting the House of Representatives decide who would be president. Seemed like a good idea, since they couldn't agree on a single candidate anyway. In New England, you had Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster, who supported Clay and could get the anti-Masonic vote. From Tennessee was Hugh White. Then the war hero, Senator of Ohio, William Henry Harrison, who defeated Tecumseh at the Battle of Tippecanoe, would take the West. Meanwhile, the little magician Van Buren, hardly the rough and ready man Old Hickory was, actually a meek senator from New York, would be running with Richard Mentor Johnson, a somewhat shocking choice, since Johnson was riddled with sex scandals. This one with Johnson's slave, Julia Chin. Being romantically involved with their slave was considered very taboo. Lots of slave owners did it, and few would admit it. It just wasn't something you would bring up at a dinner conversation. But political consequences be damned. Johnson came out with it anyway. Not only was he having an affair with a slave, they had two kids together, and Johnson wasn't apologizing for it. In 1833, Julia died, and Johnson found a new slave to be involved with. But the new slave would leave him for another man. So out of revenge, Johnson sold her at an auction and started sleeping with her sister. Johnson would make sure his two children from Julia were well-educated and taken care of until he died. But getting back to the election. Now the Whigs smelled blood. Ding, ding. Van Buren and Johnson versus Harrison, White, Webster, and yet another contender from North Carolina, William Pearson Mangum. It was on. The Democrats would win this election yet again, their third straight, this time only getting 170 votes in the Electoral College. Two more than they needed to get the majority. He won 50% popular, while Harrison came in second at 36% and 73 electoral. White came in third. Webster only got Massachusetts and no other state. And Mangum came in last. Van Buren's popularity would be short-lived. After the Panic of 1837, old Tippecanoe Harrison would come back for a rematch in the 1840 election and turn the tables on the Democratic Party. ''1856, the caning of Charles Sumner. Tensions were heating up with the slavery issue between the North and the South. The territory of Kansas was at war with itself and was bleeding. The Kansas-Nebraska Act overrode the Missouri Compromise. Uncle Tom's Cabin had been published. And for 2 days, during May's 19th and 20th, Republican Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner went on a big insult-ridden tirade against the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Fugitive Slave Act. Sumner, who detested politics, wound up leading the Republican Party after the merge from the Free Soilers, splitting from the Whig Party. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was put in by, quote, murderous robbers from Missouri, unquote, and proceeded to call them hirelings, picked from the drunken spew and vomit of an uneasy civilization, unquote. Stephen Douglas, who wrote the Kansas-Nebraska bill, was noted as saying, that damn fool will get himself killed by another damn fool. Sumner verbally attacked South Carolina Representative Preston Brooks, saying, quote, the senator from South Carolina has read many books on chivalry and believes himself a chivalrous knight with a sentiment of honor and courage. Of course, he has chosen a mistress to whom he has made his vows, and who, though ugly to others, is lovely to him. Though polluted in the sight of the world, is chaste in his sight. I mean, the harlot of slavery. For her, his tongue is always profuse in words. Unquote. On and on he went for 2 days. The Southerners didn't take too kindly to being persistently insulted like that. And the next day at work, Brooks showed up with his gold-tipped cane and beat the living daylights out of Sumner. Like Joe Pesci against a smart-aleck bartender. Yeah, like that. At the end, Sumner was bellowing like a calf, according to a letter Brooks sent to his brother the next day. Finally, folks were able to break it up, but Sumner was barely alive after the ruthless beating. Again, country was divided. The North couldn't believe what had just happened, while the South turned Brooks into a hero. A vote was cast in Congress to expel Brooks, but it did not get the 2/3. It would be a few years until Sumner would return to his seat, though Massachusetts kept voting for him to stay as senator. That little bit of violence would, of course, become widespread throughout the entire country real soon. ''1842. Howe's Cavern is purchased in Cobleskill, New York. Just in time for summer vacation in case you're anywhere near the Albany area. The secret garden is right next door, and I hear this is actually the real deal, even though Howe's Cavern has a 150-foot elevator that takes you down to the depths. Farmer Lester Howe discovered a cold spot in his acreage and found the cavern entrance. In 1843, Howe and his neighbor purchased the land and opened up a tourist center. Meanwhile, down the street, a few miles, in 1928, a couple cows named Lucky and Floyd on a nearby farm wandered away and found another cavern around 85 feet deep. Floyd and Lucky moved the attention of local civil engineer Roger Mallory, who took a look, and recruited a couple teenagers as well as the Albany Flashlight Company for sponsorship, and using an 85-foot rope, down the cavern went the teenagers. And what they found is the story that you only see in movies. No, not aliens, and not a video arcade either, but rather something better than Howe's Cavern. Remarkably, they found a 100-foot-tall waterfall. Imagine being a teenager and finding this underground. Mallory purchased the land right away and opened it up for all to see, though Howe's has always been the more popular Big Brother cavern. Mallory made things easier on his visitors and replaced the 85-foot rope with a ladder and otherwise to ease down the massive cave. But still houses the popular one. Go figure. Maybe it's that 150-foot elevator. 1966. Cloward Pevens publishes The Weight of the Poor, a strategy to end poverty. Surprisingly, most Americans don't know about how a pair of political activists called publicly for the overloading of the U.S. welfare system for the purposes of creating a crisis that would lead to a replacement of the existing welfare system with a socialist system of a, quote, guaranteed annual income, thus an end to poverty, unquote. Richard Andrew Cloward and his wife, Frances Fox Pivens, both Columbia U sociologists and members of the Democratic Socialists of America, were inspired by their idea of straining the system to cause an economic collapse by the August 1965 riots involving many African Americans in Los Angeles. I guess you just can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, right? Since LBJ was the president, and the House and Senate were controlled by the Democratic Party at that time, it seemed like the perfect opportunity for America to help individuals who were eligible for welfare and not receiving the benefits, as Cloward and Pivens claimed. Conservative writer David Horowitz explains his take on how this strategy started in his book, The Shadow Party, how George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and 60s radicals seized control of the Democratic Party. In the end, although the strategy helped to boost recipient numbers between 1966 and 1975, as historian Robert Weir wrote in 2007, the revolutionist proponents' vision never transpired.
So that is all, my friends, for May 22nd on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. Once again, I am your host, Joseph DeCristoforo. Check out the website, joesdailyushistorylesson.com. What a coincidence. It's named after the show itself. Who would have saw that coming? Let me know what you thought about today's program. I've got a comment board on there just waiting for you.
In fact, if you do take a look at the website, you'll see a lot of stuff I didn't even have time to talk about today. So let me know what you think about that. For instance,
World War II buffs. Anything else you care to add with Chattanooga Choo Choo? What about Boo fans? Do you remember a milk commercial that came out about 20 or 25 years ago? And there was some huge Aaron Burr fan, and he was trying to win a radio contest, and he just had a mouthful of peanut butter, a jelly sandwich, and no milk. He ran out of milk. And so instead of winning the radio contest by simply saying the words Aaron Burr, the only thing he could say with a mouthful of peanut butter was Aaron Burr. If you haven't seen the commercial, you got to YouTube. It's hilarious. Speaking of milk, wasn't that hysterical how I went into the story of Harvey Milk? That actually was a coincidence. I did not do that on purpose. No, but seriously, it's hard to ignore the fact that such a great man opened up the doors so much for the gay and lesbian community. It was amazing. So let me know what you thought about that. And if you have any other comments you want to mention about Pete Rose or the Unabomber, well, that's fine too. Now, moving on to tomorrow's program, I'll talk about Bonnie and Clyde, Margaret Fuller, and Lucky Lindbergh Part 1. Don't miss it. So until then, you can hit me up on Facebook, and my Facebook is simply Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. So until then, thanks for listening, everyone, and thanks for being great patriotic Americans. See you tomorrow.